Good morning, everyone, and glad you could be here this morning. I would like to introduce you to Terry and John Hale, who are co-owners of the Hale Group, an Ankeny-based consulting and advocacy firm focused on enhancing the lives of older Iowans and their caregivers by ensuring high-quality and affordable long-term care services in the setting of their choice. Terry and John are also known as visible allies of the LGBT community. They have spoken out in the media and at the Iowa Capitol for equal rights for all. Terry is a past member of the One Iowa Board of Directors, and in 2020, she was awarded the inaugural LGBTQ Ally Legacy Leaders Award. I first met Terry when we both served on the One Iowa LGBTQ Older Adults Advisory Committee for several years. And now I'd like to introduce you to Terry and John Hale.
This is a surprise to Terry, but I just wanted to recite an introduction that was made for us a couple years ago, which I think was the best introduction we've ever had. I mean, this was great, but the best introduction we've ever had was at an event at Prairie Meadows. We were emceeing a banquet for a very friendly audience, and an audience that knew us well, we knew them well. We were introduced as the Sonny and Cher of Central Iowa. Here's the best part. She, the tall, attractive, talented one. He, the hapless boob that stands beside her. So.
Bless you, dear. Thank you. This is why my life with John Hale is very interesting. A lot of surprises. First of all, Don, thank you so much for suggesting that we speak here today. I had such a pleasure of serving on those committees with Don and a number of other people here in this room that I got to be on committees at One Iowa with. Don, to me, was a super volunteer. He showed up to every meeting. He was enthusiastic. He did research in between meetings. He sent me articles. He still does sometimes. He challenged us in those meetings, and he educated me a lot about the specific challenges of being an LGBTQ older adult. So thank you, Don, for your great work. I think he deserves a round of applause. He's an unsung hero. Bill, I'm glad you told that story. And also, Mayor Pete had a phrase for people like you. It's called reasonable Republican. He knew you were out there. So thank you so much. It feels like old home week to be here because I'm seeing so many people that I haven't seen in a long time, and it's great to be back here. And I want to take one more moment to thank this group for the work that you do. I first found out about this when some scholarships were awarded at an event at Principal, and it was that event that convinced me to join our LGBTQ employee resource group and realize that as a straight ally, I might be able to be of help. And so I'm very impressed by the work that you do, and thank you for all of that. So John and I are here to talk about something that nobody really wants to talk about: growing older, needing help, and nursing homes. And we're going to tag team this. Mine's is going to be very brief. John's going to get up and talk about the very critical and serious challenges facing the long-term industry in Iowa and across the nation. But I want to take just a brief moment to talk about a part of the long-term care factor that is often not addressed enough. And it's something that if it hasn't touched you yet, it most likely will. And that is the unpaid informal family caregiver. And by family, I mean either by bloodline, by marriage, or family of choice. And by caregiving, it could be anything from taking dad to the doctor, helping them get meals, doing some finances, house cleaning, checking in to see if they're okay. Anytime there's an adult that needs some help with daily living, and you're the person doing that, you've become a caregiver. So quick survey, how many of you have been or currently are a caregiver for an adult in your life? How many of you expect to be? Well, you're in good company, because one out of five adults in our nation today is an unpaid family caregiver. And about 50% of adults expect that they're going to be one at some point. So one more quick question for you. How many of you worry about, if not dread, the idea of needing a caregiver someday? Yeah, I don't even want to think about it. So here's a startling fact on that point. Of those of us 65 and older, 7 out of 10 of us are going to need help someday with daily living. Now, I know that me and everybody else in this room are among the 3 in 10 who are not going to need help. But just in case, this part of this program is all about what do we do to get ready for that? And as you well know, this becomes even more complicated for LGBTQ older adults. As Don and I and others learned on our committee, LGBTQ older adults are twice as likely to be living alone and be single, 4 times as likely, less likely to have family or children nearby to help. They rely on families of choice. And over 80%, according to a recent AARP survey, 80% of LGBTQ adults are very worried about having adequate care and companionship in their lives. And I also read another statistic, 70%+ of older LGBTQ adults go back in the closet when they enter a long-term care facility. So being a caregiver, either being cared for or being a caregiver, emotional, exhausting, stressful, and it's a big deal. And oftentimes, those of you who've done this, you're doing this on top of working a 40, 50 hour a week job. So the one thing that we can do, though, to manage that better is be prepared for it. So this means having to talk about and think about this thing that we don't want to talk and think about. It's easier said than done. It's such an uncomfortable topic. More people have planned for their death, their funeral, than they have for their decline. So we have our obituaries written. We have our funerals written out, what we want to have happen. We've purchased our cremations. But when we had to sit down and talk about what happens between when everything's going well and the day of the funeral, that's hard. Even we live this, and it was hard to do. The worst time to do that is when somebody falls and breaks the hip, when somebody breaks their ankle, when there's a health issue and all of a sudden somebody needs that extra care, because what happens is it's all emotion. It's fear, it's worry, it's guilt. Am I doing enough? How do I know how to do this? And the emotion overrides the intellect. And anybody who's dealt with the long-term care system or Medicare, Medicaid, long-term care insurance knows you need a lot of intellect. So having some kind of plan, caregiving plan in place for myself and for the person I think I might be caring for can really create a lot of peace of mind. The good news is there are tons of free resources available, and David Cotton has posted links to a whole bunch of them that are specific to LGBTQ older adults on the First Friday Breakfast Club website under resources. They're all there right now. I wanted to tell you about one. AARP has a fabulous website devoted to LGBTQ older adult issues. And they have this publication, Prepare to Care. We have about 30 copies of these at the table that you can take home with you. This is a little bit dated version because it says LGBT on it. The one on the website, the nomenclature is a little more up to date, but all of the checklists, the resources, the advice, the templates, the how do you start the conversation, all of that is the same. So if there's enough hard copies, take one, but you can also access the updated one out on the website. One Iowa has great resources, and SAGE, if you're familiar with that organization, which was created specifically to help LGBTQ older adults, they've got great resources as well, including how do you find an inclusive long-term care facility? Let me see, what else did I want to say about this real quick before I pass it over to John? I think the basic thing is take the time to sit down with who you think might be a caregiver for you or someone that you think may need care. These materials can help you know how to start that conversation and guide you through it. So that's a quick little bit of information about the informal, unpaid caregiver side of the equation. But we know that the very critical and sometimes scary challenges right now are on the care that we pay for in the long-term care system. So my husband, John, is the right person to talk about that. He is considered an independent expert on this issue. an expert because he's been advocating for older adults for over 20 years, and independent because he's not beholden to any corporate interest, no lobbyist group, no nonprofit. He is beholden to his inner North Star that says, do the right things for the right reasons. So he can go into a room of power and say, that emperor has no clothes, and people listen to him. They may not like it, but they listen to him. But what he really lives for each day is to hear what I'm about to say next. Honey, I'm finished speaking now. It's your turn.
I brought a pile of props here this morning. I am not going to read through all of these with you this morning, but there's a story here, and I'll share it. Basic point that I want to make to you this morning is the long-term care system in this state and in this country is broken, simply broken, and it needs to be fixed. The sad thing, and this is where the pile of material comes in, the words I just used are words that have been used for 34 years. 34 years. I'm going to share one of them with you. The most recent report in this pile is from 2013 under the Obama administration. The oldest report, the 34-year-old report, September 1990. Remember September of 1990? This was a report called A Call for Action. 34 years ago, we were calling, we being the United States Congress, this was referred to as the Pepper Commission. Does anyone have enough political memory to think about what the significance of the Pepper Commission might be? Claude Pepper. Claude Pepper, both a representative and a senator from the state of Florida, was named for him because of his advocacy for older Americans for decades. But this report was the very first report of, I've got nine here in my pile, very first report that described the challenges in the long-term care system and what ought to be done about it. And they said, at the tail end of their report, four words, we must act now. 34 years ago. And this pile of documents says essentially the same thing, describes the same problems, discusses the same concerns, makes the same recommendations, calls for action. And I should say that these reports, all of them, marvelously written by smart, engaged, capable, forward-thinking people. And to think that here we are 34 years later, and hate to say this, but I'll be nice, not much of anything has been done in this 34-year period, and that is beyond being a shame. It's almost criminal. Each of these reports describes four basic things, four basic challenges in the long-term care system here in Iowa, here in 49 other states, same story. One, there's a lack of choice where people are served. The system, for some crazy reason, deems nursing homes as the preferred, the location of choice for where people are served. Now, I'm not going to ask for hands here, but I can tell you that all the surveying I've done over the years, I haven't, it's been very difficult to find anyone who will say, you know what, boy, at the end of my life, I really am looking forward to spending the last many months or years in a nursing home. People just don't say that, yet that is the public policy position we have in this country. It's crazy. People want, what they will tell you is, I want to live in my own home for as long as I possibly can. I want to live in my own community for as long as I possibly can. This is where my life has been. These are where my memories are. This is where my friends, family networks are. This is where I go to church, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't allow people to be served in the way they want, where they want. That's wrong. Number two, there's a lack of consistent, dignified, high quality care. If any of you read the news on an ongoing basis, if any of you pay attention to what Clark Kaufman writes at the Iowa Capital Dispatch, you will know that there are way, way, way too many absolute horror stories about the way people are being treated in this state and in this nation. We've seen it with family and friends. We talk to hundreds and hundreds of other people who tell us their stories, and it just shouldn't be this way. Just shouldn't be this way. Third point, there is a lack of a large enough, a stable enough, and well-trained enough workforce to do this work. And this work can be done in people's homes. It can be done in assisted living centers. It can be done in nursing homes. And there is a crisis in the number of workers that we have that's existed in every year that I've been involved in this work. I look at Matt over here, and I remember seeing him up at the Senate. My God, the workforce crisis has been discussed so long, the crisis word is kind of, it's become insignificant. I guess I would ask you, if a crisis has existed for decades and decades, well, in this case, 34 years, what's a word that describes a crisis that's existed for 34 years? I don't know what that word would be, maybe an absolute catastrophe, but it's beyond crisis. And the last is a lack of affordable care and ways to pay for it. We are talking about costs that can run, if you're talking about services in the home, we might be talking about $75,000 a year. If you're talking about services in a nursing facility, we could be talking about $150,000 or more a year. And this nation has got a crazy ass way of paying for this. Think about the health insurance side of the world. If you need care, if you got to go to a doctor, you got to go to a hospital, whatever, we have this elaborate and massive health insurance system designed to pay for the costs of this care. On the long-term care side, which can be $150,000 a year, and in the case of someone with Alzheimer's, someone could be cared for well over 10 years. Our system is to basically tell people, you're on your own, good luck. And that can translate into people spending $1 million to care for a loved one, and then using up all their assets, and then going on the state of Iowa Medicaid program. Now, what kind of a public policy is that? It is absolute nuts, and we need to, and we can do much better. So that's where we are in this nation. We've got this fundamental challenge of where we get care. We've got this fundamental challenge of the lack of consistent, dignified, basic coverage of our loved ones every day. We've got this lack of high quality care, and we've got an inability to pay for it in any kind of constructive way. So 34 years, is it going to change? I don't know. I just don't know. I can tell you what we have been told by people in Washington and people in Des Moines. When we ask them, when we tell them this story, and we make the case for why change is necessary and what ought to be done, they often will interrupt us. And they will say something like, John, Terry, we agree with you. You're absolutely right. We know we ought to be doing something, but we aren't. And then prompts the obvious question back to them, well, why aren't you? And what do you think their answer is? Their answer is this, both from Republicans in D.C. and from Democrats and Republicans in Des Moines. We aren't because we aren't hearing from enough constituents about this. And that might make us shake our heads, but there's a reality in those words. The reality is that in politics, the squeaky wheel does get the grease. And people are not talking to their elected leaders about the need to make some fundamental reforms in long-term care. They're hearing about other stuff that's more top of mind, that's more explosive, it's more emotional at the time. Let's take families who've been engaged with AEAs over their child's lifetime. They're talking to their legislators about the value of the area education agencies. They're talking about reproductive freedom. They're talking about all these headline kind of issues. And these fundamental issues, often life and death issues, are simply not getting the conversation needed. So Terry and I have talked about this. Terry and I and Dean Lerner, a friend of yours that you may know, we are talking about, in order to elevate this conversation, expand the voices, expand the impact, we're in the process of putting together a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that will raise the bar on these issues. And as that gets put together, we'd be pleased to come back and talk to you some more about it. So with that, let's just open it up for some questions. If any of you have been paying attention to the news recently, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the news about long-term care. So what's on your mind? Yes, sir.
Comes to my mind, and everything you were saying was dollar signs that involving allocating resources. The other thing that has come to my mind, because this becomes personal, when you look at the future, there's this wonderful thing called the Estate Recovery Program, which, for those not familiar with it, means if you go in on Medicaid, and when you die, the state looks back and says, oh, we spent X thousands of dollars on this person. We want it back from your heirs. You're entitled to a relative pittance, and everything else is to go to the state, which is something I'm trying to figure out a way to beat right now, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
Looking ahead, because the problem there, too, is there's a 5-year look back.
Right.
When the time comes, they look back, what was your situation 5 years ago? Not what it is today. So there are a lot of issues in this thing, and they all boil down to money. Where are we going to get the money to pay for it? Where are we going to get the money to pay for the people to increase the quality of the care and all the rest of it?
I would not disagree that much of this comes down to money. But it's not just a question of where the money's going to come from. It's a question of how the money we have is being used. It's our position that money that we have could be used in much smarter, much more effective ways. Think about this. Our first public policy of choice is to have people, when they need care, go into a nursing home, the most expensive place you can possibly go. Spend $100,000, $150,000 a year, many of those people could be cared for in their own homes at much less cost, where they want to be served. So yes, this is about how we allocate resources. Do we do what people want us to do, or do we do what has been institutionalized over the years, where we say that nursing homes are what we have? We have 407 nursing homes in the state of Iowa, the highest per capita number of nursing homes in the nation. We don't, personal opinion here, obviously, we don't need 407 nursing homes in Iowa. But why do we have and why do we continue to support 407 nursing homes in Iowa? Because we have 407 nursing homes in Iowa. And all of those have a constituency. All of them are in communities. In many cases, they're the largest employer in a community. There's an economic vested interest for communities to sustain that nursing home. So absolutely right. But that's why we need to have some critical discussions about this, where the money goes, how the money gets used, and could it be used in a smarter, better way?
And let me give one example of that. There's not a lot of transparency in how our tax dollars, and as our tax dollars are being used to pay for this care, there's a lot of waste. For example, the turnover rate in long-term care facilities is about 60%. Now, anyone working in business knows that that would be a killer for, I mean, at Principal Financial Group where I work, there's no way they would come close to that. That is a tremendous waste of money. And the sad fact is the reason there's turnover is because these people who are performing, they're giving me a bath. They're changing my diaper. From one day to the next, I don't know who's going to be there because they're making, what, 12 bucks an hour? They may or may not have benefits. They might not have health insurance, so they show up sick anyway. the workers who are providing this vital care, they're not just God-sent angels. They are, but they need to be paid and benefited appropriately. That's one of the solutions to increasing the quality at nursing homes, is by having a well-paid, well-trained, well-compensated staff, which in the long run would save a lot of money because you would have less turnover. Now, getting from here to there is the tough part, but that's an example of the kind of waste due to the lack of transparency. It could be tightened up.
Well, I think Terry's point is really well taken. I have been in way too many mind-numbing meetings over the years, sitting down with accountants for the state of Iowa, sitting down with accountants for the nursing home industry, the assisted living industry, the home care industry. Their accounting systems, the flow of money, and where the money goes is about as complicated a thing as I has ever discovered in my lifetime. It makes the Internal Revenue Code seem fairly easy to understand. So transparency is non-existent. I think there are maybe five people in the state of Iowa who truly understand where the money's going. And the more I learn about where the money is going, the more concerned I get. Because there are ways to disguise money that's flowing to, in this case, the nursing home industry, to make it appear that that nursing home is losing money. And that's the pitch they will make to legislators like Matt. Every year, we're losing money. This nursing home is going to close if we don't do something. The reality is, and the facts are, that they've figured out ways to disguise the movement of money to make it appear that that individual nursing home is losing money, when in fact the parent corporation is making all kinds of money. So we got to do something about that. Yeah. The nursing home industry wants you to believe that they're losing money. Your point disproves everything that the nursing home industry has been saying. When a Chicago-based private equity firm decides to buy 29 nursing homes in the state of Iowa for $85 million, they've made a decision to do that because they see a way to make money. They're not doing this because they're going out for some Humanitarian of the Year award. They're doing this because there's an opportunity here. So, great point. This is elevating this whole conversation about what is it that the industry's been saying all these years, and what's the reality here, and where's the truth, and how do we figure it out, and is this really a good thing for a private equity firm to be buying 29 nursing homes? Our position is absolutely not. There are so many things wrong with that decision. There is an opinion piece that Terry and I and Dean Lerner have written that's now online at the Register. It's going to be in the Cedar Rapids Gazette this weekend and some other places, talking in great detail about everything that's wrong with this purchase by a private equity firm. And solutions on what we should now do as a result of this decision, not just what decision was made, but how it was made. It was made with nobody in the loop. I've talked to people in state government who ought to have been in the loop on this decision. They were caught totally off guard. So how this decision was made, what factors were taken into account? The other thing I'll just briefly mention about this, the existing facilities that are owned by this private equity firm out of Chicago, based on all kinds of publicly available data, are providing much poorer care, much poorer quality care than the 29 facilities that they've just bought. So what's going to happen to those 29 facilities that were providing pretty decent care being bought by somebody who providing much less care, much worse care? Deeply, deeply concerning. Jonathan?
I had read something about the lack of transparency or disclosure about the details of the transaction, and that was a relatively recent change that made this equity firm not have to give access to information about the transaction. Am I correct about that?
Well, I think kind of. Jonathan, there was a 2023 bill passed by the Iowa legislature that required more financial information to be provided to the state of Iowa as part of this transaction. Now, our criticism is a couple things. One, they didn't ask for anyone to look at the quality of care that's being provided by the people that are seeking to buy this. It's purely a financial transaction. The other part is, I lost my train of thought here, Jonathan. What were you asking? Oh, disclosure. The state of Iowa's position is we can't disclose any of this information. I think that's kind of a dubious position to be taking. I think it really wasn't part of that legislation that I'm aware of. I think it's just kind of their standard operating policy that says, well, these are detailed financial transactions. They're confidential, a lot of confidential information in here. We can't tell you anything. I think there's a lot of information that they could share, but they've decided not to. Yes.
Kamala Harris has proposes covering home health care under Medicare. And I wonder if you can discuss that proposition. Are there any unintended consequences or any other? It's clearly not going to be as smooth as just saying we can do that. So I wonder if you've evaluated that proposal.
It's a great point. Now, as you might imagine, Kamala Harris's proposal has a lot of details underneath the surface, which we haven't seen. But is it the right direction to move in? Absolutely, because it responds to just what people want, and it's cheaper. Why not? Now, what are the consequences of that? Is if you move in that direction, it assumes that there's a workforce available to provide that care to people in their homes. And the reality is there's not a workforce available to provide that service to people in their homes. So that is a kind of a corollary proposition that if we're going to move in this direction, we've got to build the workforce to provide that care. But I mean, it's in a way, it's kind of a revolutionary proposal that would, per your point, take a long time to get from here to there because it's big. But it's absolutely the right thing to do for the right reason. And I hope that she gets elected, and I hope that she moves in that direction because it's just so smart, so reasonable, so responsive to what the public is asking for. Yes, in the back.
So basically, when you put your loved one in the nursing home, you pretty much sign away any right to sue them, because there's an arbitration clause you're always asked to sign, and it's going to go before people who are, you know, friendly towards this corporation or the homeowners. Has there been any talk about doing away with the arbitration and allowing people to actually go after these people when they harm their loved one?
There's been a lot of conversation at the national level about denying nursing homes the ability to utilize arbitration agreements because of just what you've said. Because they stack the deck in favor of the nursing home. It's my understanding, and I would have to double, triple check here, but it's my understanding that nursing homes, at least in Iowa, cannot force you to sign a document that says, I give up my rights to taking an issue to court. Most people don't go down that route because they're in as Terry points out, a crisis has hit. You've got to get somebody into a nursing home. You're not going to go sweat over the details at this point. You're signing whatever they put in front of you. But point well taken. I cannot tell you the number of calls I get from people who tell me about the lawsuits that they have filed and they have won that they cannot tell me anything about because as part of that settlement, they have agreed not to talk about it. So you don't see a whole bunch in the news about lawsuits that have been filed, that have been determined by a jury to be something that an individual or an individual's family could be awarded millions of dollars, because they ensure as part of the agreement that there's confidentiality clauses built into it so it never hits the news. Yes.
So as the oldest person in the room, I've got some serious...
Were you looking at me when you said that?
No. So I'm curious what we can do as constituents and individuals to grease the wheel, as you say. I'll give an example from my personal life. So I was 26, 25, 26, and my parents were in a really bad car accident. Unfortunately, my mom didn't make it. My dad is still here with us. His health has declined. He's now 72. He's been in a nursing home for 2 years. He probably will be there for 8 to 10 to 12. He's still relatively in good health, but is definitely declining and not at a point where he can live at home. He can't drive, lives in a small town. I'm not going to go 2.5 hours away every time he needs something, because I'm the caregiver. We have spent $75,000 a year. Thankfully, he has really good long-term care insurance that has an unlimited cap. So that's a blessing in disguise.
That is
amazing. But we had him, I have family down in Indianola, and we had him at Vintage Hills down there. If you know anything about the senior living communities in Des Moines or central Iowa, there's a few management companies that manage most of them. Jaybird Senior Living, which used to be Senior Housing Initiatives, purchased that from Ebenezer, who was managing it at the time and not doing a terrible job. I mean, it's an older community. But my aunt was working there. She was the executive director, and they had really good nurses. The staff was really good. They let them all go because they made too much money.
Mm-hmm.
And we just moved my dad to Edencrest in Altoona because they fired Jaybird because they were doing such a terrible job, and Hubble took over, created their own management company. I'm sure they saw money in it. And it's, you know, it's a night and day difference. But what do we do? How do I, you know, how do I point this out to other people? It's terrible. Like we're still fighting with them. His long-term care hasn't been paid in 2 months because he was in the hospital because of a fall that they should have caught. They were supposed to be helping him, you know, with he's got some incontinence issues, and they would just let him sit there for hours, days, I'm sure. He would refuse to shower. And so he fell as a result of that from a bad UTI. I had to go into the hospital. And then that was the final straw. We moved him. But I'm just, having seen that firsthand, it just, I mean, what do we do? It blows my mind. It shouldn't be like that.
Well, it shouldn't be like that for any of our loved ones or for any of our fellow Iowans, whether we've met them or whether we haven't. My God, isn't there a basic level of humanity that each and every person deserves? And those stories are just commonplace, sadly, commonplace. There are thousands of stories around this state, individuals like you who talk about what's happened to or what is happening to a family member. And sadly, those things never get elevated up to the public policy level. The one thing we always encourage people to do is talk to your legislator about this. Let them know that this is unacceptable to you. If you say that to your legislator, and if hundreds and thousands of others say that to their legislator, it's going to be pretty hard for them to just say, oh, you know, we're not going to do anything about this. So raise a little hell is maybe a blunt way to put it, but speak up, absolutely, and speak up to the right people. It's legislator. These are all policy decisions that are made by politicians, and they make decisions based on who they're hearing from and what they're hearing. So that's number one. Yes. Terry?
Well, and you said what I was going to say. We get stopped in the grocery store by people who have stories just like yours, and they say, what can I do? What I say, I don't just say contact your legislator, bug the hell out of them, and tell all of your friends to do the same thing, because I've been in the room where they have said, we're not hearing from anybody. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but they're not hearing enough and they're not angry enough. And the other thing about this is this nursing home sale, we ran into somebody who came up and talked to us about it. And she said, after that, if I have to go into a nursing home, I'm just gonna drive into a bridge abutment. Now that's kind of a plan, but this is how people feel about ending up in the long-term care industry. But you have my heart, and thank you for sharing your story.
You know, just to piggyback on what Terry just said, these are actual quotes from both her dad and my dad. Made it different times, They didn't even know each other at that time. They both said the same thing, in essentially the same words. But the basic point was, if I ever get to the point where I need to go to a nursing home, take me out behind the barn and shoot me. Isn't that interesting? It came from two different people, same generation, but that was their viewpoint. And we've heard so many people say the same kind of thing in a different way. This person that came up to us said, I'm going to drive into a bridge abutment. One person told me a few weeks ago, I'm just going to walk out in the street in front of a bus. I mean, these are not positive commentaries about end of life. We got to do something about this. We can do better. And I know we're running out of time for those of you that need to leave, but we'll stick around as long as you can.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think this is something a lot of gay people have faced, because we end up being the caregivers. You know, I ended up being the caregivers for my parents. My mother had Alzheimer's. My father lived to be 90. And I lived with them and took care of them until both of them passed. Now at 76, and I think about what I may need, families have dispersed around this country. They're no longer living next to each other. We no longer have that family support where your brother or your sister or your nieces or nephews are even in the same locality of you, that you can depend upon them for support. I've been involved with, you know, with Terry and long-term care planning for One Iowa. I've tried to be responsible thinking about my long-term care. But you start thinking about, what's going to happen to me now? I'm a single gay man. You know, my family is dispersed around the, you know, and although I have close friends, I don't think they're going to move in and take care of me. And I've tried to be responsible thinking about that, but there's very few resources. You know, when I looked for daycare for my mother as a memory care person, try to find daycare for somebody who has Alzheimer's. One, it doesn't exist very much. Yeah. And two, it's extremely expensive.
Sure.
You know, these are all, yeah, part of the problems is how our society has evolved and and how the families have dispersed around the nation. And that's something that our policy has to take into account.
And we don't have a strong service delivery system in this state that can do what, for lack of a better word, serve as a handholder or a navigator. There are many, but they are simply buried in the bureaucracy, and they don't advertise their services. The area agencies on aging, there are six of them, I think. They've been reorganized. There used to be nine, I think. Now there are six. The area agencies on aging, one is here in Des Moines, Aging Resources of Central Iowa. They have great people doing great work, but I couldn't begin to tell you the number of people who call us who've never heard of Aging Resources of Central Iowa, and we end up referring them to them, and we hear back from them and say, hey, they really were helpful. So the state of Iowa has services available, but they don't promote them. There needs to be a massive public information effort to tell people, here's where you go. Here's who you call. You don't have to call us. We're happy to talk to you, but there are services available to you. They need to be promoted better.
And the best kept secret in Iowa is called Lifelong Links. It's an 800 number. That's a program of the area agencies on aging that you can call. It's free. I used it to find stuff for my dad, even though I lived with this guy, trying to navigate what they call the elderly waiver in Iowa. So confusing. They saved me. So that is on that page that David Cotton, list of resources, and you can use that phone number if that helps.
I have one quick story. I am one of those family care members. My parents are both 97. They live in their home. They have been here since John and I moved back in 2018, 2019. I started doing this. I've been doing it full time since then. And I want to tell you that we have got two full-time caregivers in their home 24 hours a day, because my mother has Alzheimer's. My dad's dementia has just gotten really poor. Yesterday, a good example, we had two doctor appointments, one at 1 o'clock, one at 3 o'clock. And it's a team effort. My gosh, my sister and I both had to cover those appointments. My sister's retired. I have my own business in Indiana still. And so I travel back and forth once a month, but I've been doing this for 5 years. And let me tell you something. We are paying a billed rate for our caregivers, $34 an hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Do the math. $600,000, $700,000 a year to do this. And they absolutely must have it because we started 5 years ago with one caregiver from morning till they were retired at night. And then they were in their home by themselves overnight. Progressively got worse. And now, you know, my father requires somebody in the shower with him. Thank God they both, they moved in 2000 and they moved into a home that they were going to age into. So it's a single level. I just can't tell you the number of other costs you have to make a home accessible. You guys are now getting older and you're thinking, if you've been in your home for a while, think about moving into a house if you want to stay there and be cared for in your home. Make it friendly, make it level, make it ADA acceptable, big showers, big toilet, you know, big bathrooms, very flat floors. And it's sort of those soft costs that nobody ever knows about. And that add to this. We had to buy a handicap accessible van because in Des Moines, I was just shocked at this. My mother's knee got infected. She went into the hospital for a week and I needed transportation from Mercy to their home in West Des Moines. I could not find anybody, a handicap, Joy or anybody would pick her up from the hospital. We had to have an ambulance take her from the hospital to the house. Now, they'll take you to doctor appointments. They'll take you to the grocery store, blah, blah, blah. They'll do all that. And that's when we made the decision, screw this, we're going to have to buy our own vehicle. So we traded in one of their cars and bought a handicap van. And that's been a godsend because now we have total control because of appointments and all these kinds of things. I want to just tell you, it's a full-time job. Yeah. Taking care of their house, taking care of their finances, taking care of their dog, taking care of all these other side things that make their lives enjoyable. And that's the key. That's the key. So just a real life story.
Well, that's a great example. And I can also hear just the stress. And I don't know if you were like, when I was caregiving for my dad, I also had a lot of guilt. Am I doing enough? Am I watching enough? Am I caring enough? Your parents are really lucky to have you. And one of the things I want to mention about that is caregivers don't end when someone needs long-term care. We're all going to need an advocate on the outside, somebody to manage. They've got you guys to manage all this stuff. If they were in a nursing home, they'd still need you to manage because somebody needs to show up and be eyes and ears. When my dad was at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown, I showed up. I was eyes and ears. He had dementia. I was walking out one day, and another guy's walking out with me, and he said, oh, do you have somebody here in the memory care unit? And I said, yeah, my dad. And I said, you know, he's getting great care here. I'm just so impressed with this place. And I said, and who are you? He said, well, I run the place. I can't remember what the title is, adjutant general or something like that, commandant, you know. And I said, well, I just want to tell you this nurse and that. And he said, would you write me a letter to that effect? So I did. And he published it in the newsletter. So then the staff knew I was on a first name basis with the guy that runs the place. And I'm telling you, my dad got good care. You should have seen the stream of people when dad was on his last moments coming in to see him. I think that they also cared, but then they're also thinking, this lady will tell if I don't show up. I'm not sure, but really, we need that squeaky wheel. My middle daughter, you know, middle daughters, she's going to be my squeaky wheel. I've asked her to do it.
A last question I would say is that you have this audience of people and others getting us excited and kind of depressed and concerned about the future. What is the actionable homework you'd ask each person here to do and also to pass on to a friend to do as well?
Well, get to know who is your elected lawmaker in the legislature, not just today, but in some cases, let's hope it's changing after Tuesday. Get to know them, find out how to contact them. Do not be afraid. And Matt, I'm sure, could give you tips on the best way to do it. And then raise hell about this. And if we get this nonprofit started, it'll be an opportunity to join in a thing that'll become a cause that will organize visibility around this issue. And then take the action to prepare yourself. Find out who could be my caregiver. Set something up with them. get all your documents in order. This prepare to care brochure shows, what do I need to have in order? How do I do it? I know it's hard. We hated doing it, but do that. And then if there's someone in your life that you believe you're going to be caring for, maybe it's your partner. Maybe you have an elderly relative. How do you talk to them about it? These materials can help you do that.
I would not disagree. Planning, preparing, listening to your story, by the way, I mean, there was so much packed into that story about caregiving, about costs, about how you pay for this stuff. I mean, you're talking about an extraordinary amount of money. Alzheimer's has really, it was a game changer when we started to identify more and more people that had this thing called Alzheimer's or dementia, because this is something that it doesn't go on for a year and then someone dies. It can go on literally for over a decade at tremendous cost, financial cost, also costs of time and effort and the drain, the psychological impact on the caregiver. We've seen some data, for example, that says it's quite often that the stress of the caregiver is so much that the caregiver will die before the family member that they are caring for dies. That's not going to happen to you.
But to that point, are you doing things to care for yourself? Yeah. And I think telling that story like you did today is important.
So anyway, thank you all very much for the opportunity to be here. It was a real treat and hope to see you again.